After the fall of Saigon, thousands of Vietnamese families fled their country by sea. For 21 years, from 1975 to 1996, these refugees, who would come to be known as the Boat People, braved open waters and countless dangers only to face an uncertain future as they made landfall on foreign beaches across the South China Sea. Karina Huang, who left Vietnam by boat in 1977, has documented the struggles of these people in a collection of personal accounts called Boat People. She joins us now, along with two fellow boat people and contributors, David Lee and Lala Stein. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
I should make the point that Lala, you weren't really a boat person, but you had similar experiences, and we'll get to those.
Yes.
Karina, it's been almost 40 years since you left Vietnam by boat, and your background is in business and chemistry. Have you been thinking about doing a book like this all that time?
No, I have not. A long time ago, I thought of someday I would document these stories, and mainly for my families and my children. But once I started the book, I realized that it's not just for us, it's for the world to know as well.
And you've done it with pictures as well, because that was an important part of telling the story?
I think so, yes.
You're involved in an effort to find lost graves of former refugee camps former refugee campsites. Can you talk about that work?
Yes. When I escaped in 1979, my cousin also left at about the same time, and he died of malaria and was buried in the jungle.
What percentage of the million people who left died before they ever could get out of a refugee camp?
According to the UNHCR, the estimated 1 out of 3 perished. So
you're looking at
approximately 300,000 people died in South China Sea during the exodus.
David, Karina helped you find your mother's grave. Did that inspire you to share your story?
Yes. Actually, I ran across Karina over to internet of her story. And since I came to the United States when I was 11, and me and my sister, we came here with my sister, a family of five here. And we always tried to find a chance to get over there to Indonesia. But we just, you know, my mom is, when we left the country, we went to separate boat. So my mom and my sister went to Indonesia, and me and my sister went to Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
When we were doing the camp, the refugee camp, we found out our mom has passed away in the Indonesia. So we never seen her, and we don't know where the camp is, and we don't know where she buried. So when we ran across the story from her, Karina here, then I searched and I looked for her and asked her, "Hey, how did you get there?" You know, because we've been asked a lot of friends from Indonesia, and they don't know what the island of Kuku Island is. They don't even know because they have so many islands over there. So we ran across from her and asked her, "How did you get there?" And I say, "You know, can you show me how to get there?" And they say, "Oh, you know what? We're going to be having a trip over there with a group of people, about 12 people of us, going there in September of the next year." I say, "Oh, good, count me in," you know, and then that's how I start and communicate with her.
Well, how did you find these camps and the grave sites?
In 1998, I went back to those camps to look for my own cousin's grave. And to find those islands is nearly impossible because they were not on the maps anywhere. Even local people didn't know about it, but I got help from the Indonesian government.
Well, when the boat people left Vietnam, did they land on these islands, or did they land on larger islands and get moved to these refugee camps on the small islands?
For the majority part, we were put there by the Indonesian government once we get to their border.
And most of the refugees wound up either in Malaysia, Indonesia, or Thailand. Were the experiences similar in all of those different places?
It's different because each country has their own rules and the situations varies, especially in Hong Kong. It's very different than Malaysia or Indonesia. But in our case, we were left on an uninhabited island, so it was extremely difficult to survive at that time.
Now, Lala, how did you come in contact with Karina?
Well, after she got to a camp and we contact them by, you know, just listen to radio station. And they said, yeah, they just got the boat. And back then, we have to hide a little radio to listen to BBC under the bed because we're afraid that, you know, our neighbor will go and report on us because that's just right, 1979.
You had tried to leave with your family?
Yes, I have.
And you were left behind?
Yes. That boat that my sister and my other sibling were on, that boat, I was supposed to be on that boat with them. But the next morning I got up, my mom said they already left. She tricked me. So she said stay because I have a younger sister. So I stayed until I was 16 years old. I was pretty much lost. I need to be with my sibling, and I left home.
You try to escape?
I try to escape.
To go to Thailand?
Yes. So I hitchhiked from Vietnam, from Saigon, all the way down to south of Vietnam is Châu Đốc. And then from there, I get on the ship and the little boat to get on the Mekong River to go to Cambodia. So that's where I stayed in Cambodia, at stranger's house, who organized for the people like me to escape to go to Thailand. And at that time, we don't know what time we were hiding under the basement, and to the point that they said, nope, the route to go to Thailand is not safe anymore. And they said that we all have to go back to Vietnam.
So you went back to Vietnam. You tried to escape 3 or 4 times. And this was a very, I don't want to make you uncomfortable here, but it was a rather dangerous situation. You write about being raped at one point.
Yes, I was raped in Cambodia. And because I was with among other strangers, stayed at other people's house, and I have no where I was, and when I was there, get ready to go back to Vietnam, and I would just worry about that when I go back to Vietnam, I don't know what can happen to my faith because now I have to deal with government because I escaped this criminal. Yes, I was raped. And I went back to Vietnam, and I got captured by a local government. And luckily, I have sucked away some gold that I have, that I pack it with me. So I gave it to them, kind of pretty much like bribed them to let me go home. So I found my way back home to my mom.
And then eventually you were allowed to leave legally.
Yes.
That was that a rare situation, or was that just a change in the government attitude about people leaving Vietnam?
I think that kind of both. I mean, rare, that's, the timing is not good. I mean, they could have let me go in 1997, 1998 or 97, but they didn't let me go. The government say, nope, you're not leaving anywhere. So that's why I thought, you know what, I have to take care of my own own life. So I have to go to escape. And of all the things that happened to me, I left my mom, and I felt like I'd be in gratitude to her that left my mom and left my little sister and my dad in concentration camp. And then, you know, I came back with brokenhearted for a young girl like me, 16 years old, and I felt like my life was over. And I decided, okay, that's it. I'm going to stay in Vietnam. That's the fate that I have to be. And until 89, the government said that I can go now. And kind of like, I have to do it. I have to come over. So finally, I flew.
My guests are Lala Stein, David Lee, two of the contributors to a book that has been edited by Karina Huang called Boat People, Personal Stories from the Vietnamese Exodus, 1975-1996, published by Karina Huang Communications. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Karina, were all of the refugee camps dangerous?
Yes.
Especially for women, I assume, but for everyone?
For everyone, but children and women are much more vulnerable.
And what was your situation? You were one of the early people to leave. Did it? Was it better then than it was later when the camps got really full?
It was worse at first because we were the first group that were put on that island and it was uninhabited. And death was so near that I was prepared to die. My sister, my brother, and I, we all got malaria and diarrhea. And around us, people died. We buried someone every day. So we were prepared to die. But we were lucky because after I left that island, I learned that at least 300 people had been, buried in that jungle, which I returned in the last 5 years. Every year I return, I found more graves. In fact, I just come back 2 weeks ago, and after all those years, I still found 6 more graves that have not been recognized.
Now, wasn't it dangerous even before you wound up in the refugee camp? Most of the boats that people were living in were designed to go on rivers, not on the open sea.
Well, not only that, the chance of survival for both people like us at that time, I now realize, is probably less than 10%. Because
so a lot of people died and never made it to land?
Right. A boat could be taken down by a wave, by a storm, and hundreds of people would be disappeared. Or we can die under the hands of pirates. There are thousands of stories of women and young girls were raped repeatedly by pirates, brutally in front of their loved ones. And also people died because we could run out of food and water. On my boat, we actually lost a few people that we had to toss the bodies to the ocean. And that was the worst thing I've witnessed until today. I still could not erase that image where families were crying and hang on to the feet of the dead body because they were hoping to bury the mom, but we couldn't do that.
David, what were the circumstances of your escape? Where did you, what kind of boat were you in, and where did you wind up landing?
Well, actually, our boat is land in Malaysia, but our boat is actually have 24 yard long the length and about 10 to 12 feet wide yard.
So it was more comfortable than a lot of the boats that people left on.
Well, we have 680 people in that boat.
Oh, wow.
So imagine we sit like sandwich. And but we experience, we have about four day, 3 night on the sea. And we experienced one rough, and the rest we pretty much have a smooth ride. But this is a wooden boat that is a custom make for the people to escape.
And were you aiming for Malaysia, or did you just trust that you'd land somewhere?
Actually, I don't know where I'm going to. The captain, I don't know how much experience he have, but we are 680 people on his hand. So we experience whatever he take us, that's where we're going to go. And we don't know where we go. We're not sure we go Thailand, Malaysia, or anywhere else.
And I'm sure you were also fearful of an attack by pirates.
Yes, we are. We're getting close, but we're not that close to that route.
So and then what was the refugee camp like? Was it as bad as what we've heard from Karina and Lala?
Well, mine is actually we on the around the sea in Malaysia around 3 months. We on our boat is that we went to Malaysia the first time we land is 4 days and 3 nights, and then after that during the time that we was have a lot of refugees was escaped from Vietnam. So most of the camp in Malaysia is closed down, and they want all the refugee boat is go to Indonesia instead of go to Malaysia. So when we get to Malaysia, they don't let us in the refugee camp at all. So they keep pulling us out. We go in, we pull out, we go in, we pull out. So we go to different island, and until the last time that we decide not to do anymore, then we just sink our boat on the island. So then that's the last time we get on the ocean again. So the Navy from the Malaysia have to come and pick us up, so we go to the camp.
My guests are David Lee and Lala Stein, two of the contributors to a new book called Boat People, Personal Stories from the Vietnamese Exodus 1975-1996, edited by its publisher, Karina Huang. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Karina Huang, who has edited and published a book called Boat People, Personal Stories from the Vietnamese Exodus, 1975-1996. Also with us are two of the contributors to the book, David Lee and Lala Stein. So how long were you at the refugee camp, David?
18 months.
And then you came to the United States?
Yes, came to the United States.
And Karina, how long?
10 months for us.
And then you came to the United States as well,
yes,
although you have left.
I'm sorry?
You came here to where?
Yes, I came to Philadelphia.
Uh-huh. But now you have moved to Australia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Lala, you also went to Philadelphia. Is there a large Vietnamese population in Philadelphia?
Yes. Yes. A lot.
Uh-huh. But in your case, you after you were allowed to leave Vietnam by the government, did you come directly to the United States?
Come right to, we have to stop in Thailand in the camp for 3 weeks. And then I came to Philadelphia to be with my brother and sister.
So I would assume that if there's a large population, you have you can actually recreate Vietnamese food because there are usually shops that sell that. But David, you live in Georgia.
Yes.
Can you get the ingredients necessary to make
ingredients.
A decent Vietnamese meal?
Actually, I do have my own restaurant in Atlanta. We currently have about 8 locations in Atlanta.
Vietnamese restaurants.
Vietnamese and Thai, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, today's the ingredient is pretty easy around in the United States across the country. We do have a good supplier around the United States. So anywhere in the United States, you pretty much have the ingredient for the Vietnamese food.
Mm-hmm. Well, you rely on Chinese suppliers in many cases, don't you? There are a lot of similar ingredients.
They do have a lot of Chinese and Vietnamese, but they do a lot of importer coming from Vietnam also, especially the fish sauce and stuff like that, yes.
And Karina, what led you to leave Philadelphia where there were so many Vietnamese people and go to Perth, Australia?
I marry an Aussie.
Ah, That'll do it. In leaving the refugee camps, how difficult was it? Did you have to deal with a lot of bureaucracy?
It was not the bureaucracy, but we all had to wait for the process. And especially for us, we were left on an uninhabited island and were deserted for 3 months. Nobody from the outside world knew we were there. And we've lost hundreds of lives until the Red Cross flew with a helicopter around to look for stranded people like us. So by the time they found us, we went through the process. It took that long for us to start to leave the camp.
How did you find things to eat, for example?
At first, we went to the jungle. And we ate roots, flowers, anything that looked safe enough to eat. And eventually local fishermen come around to trade fish and vegetables for valuables. So those who have gold or jewelry or money can buy food. Those who didn't continue to be hungry. Mm. And we lost a lot of people during that time, sadly.
From starvation.
Starvation, diseases. Everybody got sick.
You didn't have a similar experience, David.
No, but I think my mom was in the same island with the Karina here. She actually is the first, what I've been talking to her since I know her, that I learned that she was the first boat in the island, and my mom is probably the third boat on the island. So we know that the first 5, a lot of people died from those.
Now, why did your families feel necessary to leave? Many people stayed back and lived under the new political system. Would it have been impossible for you, Karina?
The situation was affecting pretty much millions of people in the South. There's persecution. Those who served in the military and the government were put in political prison for as long as 18 years.
Re-education camps?
Yes.
Yeah.
Our father was captured and put away for 14 years. Our houses were confiscated. My mom could not get a job to raise her 7 children. We at first couldn't go back to school, so things were tough. And then eventually, because Vietnam had war in Cambodia and young people were sent to fight, and my mom thought it's time for her to let go of her children before they died in battlefield.
Lala, your father was sent to a re-education camp?
Yes, my dad. Mm-hmm. Well, just so you know, Karina is my sister.
Ah.
Yes.
So you were the one left behind.
I was the one left behind, yes. And my dad was in concentration camp. It was hard. Like, you were talking to David and my sister about the camp, the jungle. And for me, that my journal for, I would say, 5-6 weeks that I was, I left home, hitchhiked to Cambodia. And that was more like a hell to me. That was a lot of happening. It's not like a...
Well, Cambodia was also at that time, was under Pol Pot's regime,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
That was even scarier than what was happening in Vietnam.
Yes. And I was by myself. I was by myself. And the group that I tag along with, there's other 6-7 people that we don't know of, and we all try to protect ourselves. And yes, and I couldn't make it to Thailand because there was a lot of private pirate at the time, and thing that happened to me, and I was alone by myself. 16 years old is, it was a lot.
The re-education camp, what did they try to re-educate your father to do? To not be an opponent of Ho Chi Minh?
The government call it re-education camp instead of calling it a political prison.
But
basically it's prison for political prisoners. They try to brainwash people, but how could you? So being kept in prison like that for 14 years, it do damage to people. My father, when he came out, physically he was all pretty much destroyed, but mentally he's wounded since. In fact, I'm about to go and visit my dad in Sacramento, and he recently experienced dementia. And sadly, when he's not feeling well, he thinks that he's still in prison.
Mm. How difficult was the process of proving that you were refugees when you wanted to come to the United States?
Back then, it was quite easy. Almost everyone who left Vietnam by boat was given refugee status at that time.
The same for you, David, because you're a few years later.
Yes. I left the country since 79, and at that time it's not like critical, more like in 75 to, I think those like it more like government not involved. And I think it's reaching 78, they do a government kind of open up and left only the Chinese background to left the country. They pretty much asked the Chinese to go.
Now, we should point out that Vietnam has a large Chinese population, but there's often been tension between the Chinese population and the rest of the Vietnamese population. In New York, most of the Vietnamese restaurants are really Chinese-Vietnamese, aren't they?
Yes, there's a big population here in New York, yes.
Because I remember somebody, a Vietnamese person, when I said, oh, I like that Vietnamese restaurant, they said, that's Chinese-Vietnamese, as though it wasn't as good.
Yes, Vietnam always have the history with Chinese, and there's a very large Chinese population in Vietnam at one time, and they pretty much dominate the economy as well. They're concentrated in an area called Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there's also a very strong French influence, isn't there?
Yes.
Yes.
And is that evident in your restaurants, David?
On the French?
Yes.
No, actually, our restaurant is, like you should say, that's a Chinese restaurant. Most of Vietnamese customers that come to our restaurant, they think that we are a Chinese Vietnamese, not a really Vietnamese restaurant. But, we have a different taste in that. Yeah.
But when you come to my house, yes, you may taste some French in my Vietnamese cooking.
Now, how much of a culture shock was there when you arrived?
When I was right, I was almost 21 years old. Imagine that, 21 years old.
And you'd been through a lot at that point.
Yes, and I did not speak English. I took some lessons when I was home, but just about say, hi, how are you? Already got me sweating. Like, oh my God, I'm shaking. I don't know. And I see the side of people and the height and the side. And, I said, and building so big. So shocked. I mean, take time to learn the rope is incredible. And just for example, how to look in the map. And phone book, that was culture shock already for me. And I have to give credit to my husband, Howard. He, the one, taught me how to look at the map. So now when we go to family trip, he always just make me look in the map, even though we have GPS.
Just so that you have the experience and have a sense of where you are at any given time. And for you, Karina, you were younger when you arrived. Did that make it easier to make the adjustment?
No, it did not. When I first came to America, I thought, oh my God, surviving the jungle and the boat journey was easier than surviving it in America, especially learning English. I didn't think I would make it. I don't know about other people, but I think the majority those who came to America for the first time felt very scared and lack of confidence, even destitute sometimes. You know, I felt depressed because I couldn't talk to people. I thought in the jungle, even though I was hungry, at least I can tell people I was hungry or hurt. But in America, food wasn't abundant, but I couldn't tell people that.
Well, there were pockets of Vietnamese populations. There's one in Houston. There are some others in California, often in areas that are similar to Vietnam. But Philadelphia? Atlanta, Georgia?
No, actually, when I just arrived to the United States, it's, imagine you're in El Paso, Texas. Mm-hmm. And when we get to El Paso, Texas, I guess we only one Asian in the airport. And our sponsor came to pick us up at that time with a family of seven, that my sister and two out of. And we came to their house and small house, and we opened up the fridge. It's only one bottle of Coke. That's it. I said, oh, man, what happened here? How are we going to survive here? And El Paso, Texas, it's only us as an Asian at that time. I said, well, how we communicate around here, you know?
And how did you wind up opening your first restaurant?
My mother-in-law and my father-in-law, they have restaurant in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So
and you knew the business.
Yeah, and I like to eat.
Karina, you have lots of pictures in this book, photographs. Were they supplied by the contributors to the book?
I sourced most of them out from the UNHCR, from Hong Kong government, from the newspapers, and some are from private sources. One of the pictures, I actually got them from the Defense Department of America.
Mm-hmm. Mm. They're, 'cause some of them are quite powerful, but we see people in boats. We see people in the jungle, in refugee camps. All documented.
Yes.
When you saw these pictures, did they bring back sad memories?
They did. And also, I thought I was a boat person. I was part of the whole Exodus. I pretty much know a lot about it, but I did not. Once I interviewed these people, I realized that I was very lucky. I mean, I knew that, but by interviewing them and hearing about their stories, I know a lot of people have experienced worse than I had.
And looking over this book, did you have similar feelings of sadness, David?
Yeah, when I looked through all the, we have a chance to talk to Karina about the doing the trip that going to the Indonesia. We share a lot of story of our back in the old day that we was on the boat. And so when we look back and look at my mom, Gray, and everything, I saw we was crying.
Lala, are you tempted to go back to Vietnam?
Yes.
Have you gone back? Is it easier now?
Yes, it's a lot easier now to visit, yeah.
And you're a lot closer, Karina, because you're in Australia.
Yes, from Perth to Vietnam now it's only 7 hours flight.
I want to thank you all for being on our show. Karina Hoang, her book, Boat People, Personal Stories from the Vietnamese Exodus, 1975-1996, and two of the contributors, David Lee and Lala Stein. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.